Welcome to Creative Squares, where we discuss the intersection between art, science, maths, and technology. I'm Alex Lovelace.
I'm Mark Burden.
Today we're going to discuss fractals, what they are and how they appear in maths, nature, and art. We'll also lightly touch on the themes of recursion, repetition, and chaos in art. Let's start with a discussion of what fractals are. Here's a definition that ChatGPT gave me. Fractals are intricate geometric patterns that exhibit self-similarity at various scales, meaning their structure appears similar regardless of the level of magnification. So basically, fractals are things that when you zoom in, they look the same as their zoomed out version. What do you think when you think of fractals, Mark?
I think of fractals, like you say, as something that when you zoom in, it looks similar to when you zoom out. And I'm fascinated by the fact that when you think about them, they kind of like link into human perception of infinity. So when we think about fractals, we think about these jaggedy, edgy, kind of like slightly random shapes that repeat in nature. And usually when we think about the world, we think about it in terms that human beings understand. So miles, kilometers, and it breaks down into measurements. But when we look at the landscape, just say the island of the UK, and we measure it from a fractal perspective, moves to infinite because we've got, you know, infinite number of edges to these shapes that make up the outline of the UK. So that's the kind of the framework that I've got for understanding fractals. And I think, Alex, you've done more research into this because it kind of affects things like programming, you know, in computers and stuff like that. And also it links into, as you mentioned, the chaos theory. Personal perspective, what do fractals mean to you? And how does that relate to some of the stuff you're doing in your art?
One of the reasons why I wanted to talk about this is because I spend a lot of time walking around my local area. I live in sort of central Scotland. We have a lot of trees. We have a lot of foliage. There's a lot of countryside. That's why I live here. One thing I see a lot of is trees, and also underneath those trees, I see a lot of ferns. And I think in particular, those two objects are very clear and obvious examples of fractals. And so if you probably not the right time of the year for those living in the UK, but in a month or two, you'll start to see that the ferns will come out. And if you look at them, the individual sort of fronds are really just little colonies of little similar fronds. And so that's a sort of classic fractal shape where you see the form of the main plant reflected in its leaves. And so the trees are another good example. At this time of the year, you've got the trees branching off. So if you snapped off a branch or a twig with a few outcrops, you would see what looks ultimately like a little tree. And anyone can see this. And then later on this year, when the leaves come out, we've got the leaves on those trees. And if you look at the structure of the leaves, you'll see a tree-like structure within that. And that's a very classic fractal. So I see that everywhere. And what's interesting to me is, especially at the moment, if you look up at the trees, if you're in like a forest or the woods, or even if you're in, particularly if you're in a redwood forest, because conifers are typically very fractal, what you see is just noise, right? You don't see very much structure at all. But if you then focus in on one tree, or you take a branch or a leaf, you'll start to see that there's real order in there. And that actually trees are highly ordered structures, especially when left to sort of grow. Particularly coniferous trees are very, very ordered structures. And I find that really, really interesting, this concept of when you see something close up, you see something similar to when you zoom out. And that certainly turns up in my art a certain amount. And it turns up in art of all kinds everywhere, both in terms of sort of fractal or recursive motifs, and in terms of of actual fractals. So fractals themselves are a well-defined mathematical object. So the most obvious example is if you go and Google Mandelbrot set, you'll see what looks like this sort of psychedelic pattern that blossoms out almost like an explosion from some circles. And you'll see all sorts of colors and forms, but no matter how far you zoom in, you'll see exactly the same structure. And that's defined by a mathematical function created by a guy called Benoit Mandelbrot in the early 80s. And it's a really fascinating object. And as you pointed out, Mark, it gives us a sense of the infinite. Because although that Mandelbrot set, when visualized, isn't, you know, cannot be infinite on a page or on a screen, it is infinite in its structure. And as long as you've got a program that can keep manifesting that, you can zoom in infinitely. And so when you look at these things, you're seeing infinity on the screen.
Yeah, no, I mean, in one sense, it's you get the zoom in and the zoom out. And that's something that we've seen in a number of artists. And, you know, as you're talking about this, I'm just reminded of Van Gogh's landscapes and the way that he plays around with the kind of patterns, the patterns of the micro and the macro in a landscape. And you see it specifically in the way that he draws, you know, the kind of like the draw marks. And then again, it's reflected in his paintings. But yeah, I mean, that's an interesting insight, Alex. I mean, I've got this portion of an image in the background, which is a grid made up of squares, which is a square image in a square frame. So yes, there's a level of recursion to what I do. And within this particular grid, you've got squares that are squares that are referencing Mona Lisa, so Fibonacci, which we talked about before, which is kind of somehow related to fractals, even though I couldn't mathematically tell how it is, and, you know, computer circuit boards. So there's a level of analogy in this particular piece that you can't really see clearly. That relates very closely to fractals in ways that I didn't fully understand.
I'm glad you brought up the Fibonacci golden ratio thing. There is an overlap, certainly in terms of recursive nature. But there is such a thing I discovered called Fibonacci words. So Fibonacci words are sequences from the Fibonacci sequence, are contiguous digits that can be then Fibonacci'd, right? If that makes any sense, where you add, so you create a sequence of those from somewhere in the Fibonacci sequence, and you add the next sequence to the first sequence and the third sequence to the second sequence and on, and then you can visualize that and get a fractal visualization that's really quite beguiling. And so, yes, there's a direct overlap, and I think any sort of recursive function that can be visualized will have some sort of fractal nature to it. To name a few others, the other classic one is the Coke snowflake, but that's got nothing to do with the drink or the drug, funnily enough, but it's spelled K-O-C-H, which is what happens when you take an equilateral triangle, an inverted equilateral triangle on it, and then do that for every equilateral triangle around the edge, right? It's easy to see if you go and look it up. For those on video, I'm sure I'll paste in an image of this, and that creates what's, you know, effectively an infinite snowflake. We have other things like the Cantor set, which is a very early example of a fractal type structure. The Julia set, strange attractors. We've got the Menger sponge. I don't know why that makes me laugh, but it's a naturally funny name. But the Menger sponge looks like a ball cube. That's what I thought when I looked at it. And we have what's this? A Sierpinski tetrahedron, which is like a pyramid of pyramids, right? And or rather, it's a tetrahedron of tetrahedrons. And we'll come back to the Platonic solids another day, I think. But I think hopefully within these descriptions, we have this sense of one shape within another. And And I think in maths, this is really important. And because these things, we think about them, particularly the Mandelbrot set, as a mathematical function, in some senses, the mathematicians don't care that much about it. It's more the numbers. And thus we get the overlap with things like topology and stuff as well, which has lots of weird recursive sort of elements to it. And also is both visual and mathematical. And so I think, much like the golden ratio, this is a really, really good illustration of where maths, particularly maths and art, directly overlap. When something in mathematics can be expressed directly in something that is not only visible to humans, but is visually appealing. Unlike, for example, you know, n-dimensional spaces, where you might have exotic mathematical structures buried in an n-dimensional vector space, but humans can't visualize it, right? It has no meaning to us because we can only go up to three dimensions. So I think it's a really, really good example of the beauty in maths.
I think the interesting thing is how this links to topology as well. So if you start talking about topology, then you're into manipulation of shapes, how one thing morphs into something else by applying a mathematical formula. So that for me is a really interesting journey, and it's one that has fascinated me in terms of my exploration of art. Why does one thing become another, and how does one thing morph into something else? And is there still a ghost of the original form inside the manipulated topology of the final form?
And of course, this is like the human is a donut thing, right? So humans are toruses, right? We're basically a pipe through the middle with some stuff around the outside. So your average topologist doesn't distinguish between a human and a donut, right? And that's what you're saying. And there's an overlap here in the sense that, the original form is in there. Except in fractals, the form is self-similar. So either exactly the same or very similar when you drill down. Whereas a human and a donut are not often, it's not often that people confuse humans and donuts.
But you could confuse human and donuts if you were looking at it purely from that. Some of their mathematical dimensions. So something around a hole in the middle. And so there is a link. It's just that we wouldn't necessarily see it from a human interface.
Yeah, and I like that crossover. And I think we'll probably have to come back to topology.
I think so. Yeah. It's not really the topic of the conversation today, but it's really interesting how, you know, you start talking about one thing and before we know it, we're talking, you know, we're linking it into Fibonacci, we're linking it into topology, and we're linking it into vectors.
Well, I think, and I'm almost going to take the other stance that I did last week on the golden ratio with regards to, well, is it really there everywhere where people see it? I'm absolutely not convinced, but I see fractals everywhere. Are they actually there? Other people might not be convinced, but I'd argue it. And I see them all over the place. And I think the other area of sort of maths that this blossoms out into much more directly is chaos theory, right? We go into the whole butterfly flaps its wings in Beijing, and we get a hurricane in Florida. The small changes on a detail level can lead to very big fluctuations in terms of the macro. And so when you zoom out or zoom in, you know, you can make changes to these functions and you get you know, very, very different results. And from there, we can easily jump into a cellular automata, but we'll come back to that one another day. But I think I love this idea, and it particularly comes out to me as I describe when you're walking around nature, in that if you sort of blur your eyes a bit, you've just got noise almost, right? Like it's almost like there's, no matter which direction you're looking, you're in a forest and everything is basically the same. But if you then focus in on anything in that forest, you're going to see a massive structure, right? Lots of, you know, we can touch on entropy here, right? A very, very low level of entropy in a very high, a seemingly high entropy environment And for me, that's one of the most beguiling concepts in maths and art and so on, that there's always more to look at. There's always more to see. And I think with regards to sort of looking for fractalism, for want of a better term, where it isn't necessarily there, I think paintings, for example, are a really good place to start. And are they fractal? Well, no, not really. But are they self-similar? Often, yes. And I think a good place to start there is, for example, Jackson Pollock, right? Whereby if you see this sort of big chaotic canvas of dripped paint, every time you get closer to it, what you're going to see is a vista of dripped paint, right? And further in, a vista of drip paint. But when you get really close to it, you're still seeing a vista of drip paint, but there you'll find structure. You'll find structure in different areas of those paintings that tell a different story. And they're quite fractal in their nature, even though in itself, you know, it's not a mathematical function.
I was actually thinking about the way in which Jackson Pollock painted. So although the paint, as it impacts the canvas, will have a particular a characteristic mark of, you know, paint splatters. The rhythmic movement in which Pollock was moving to create the work was, in fact, based around the human form and repetition of the human form in motion, and links back to some of the native Indian dance and spiritual practices that they had, you know, maybe throwing sand around or stuff like this. So it's interesting to see that you get a fractal result from this collision of paint and a hard surface or a soft surface, and you can see the fractals there. But it's also interesting to think about the way in which that was created, the rhythmic movements of the human body in motion.
I mean, I love that, right? So I hadn't even thought of it that way. But so let's just unpack that for a second, because we get into things like nonlinear dynamics here really quickly. If you take a bucket and place and fill it with paint, is this how he did it? I don't remember. Did he? So did he do it with a bucket or did he just splat it on?
I think he used a mixture of both. I think that there was probably a way. I mean, he was called Jack the Dripper, wasn't he? So it was kind of like a, you know, he dripped things onto the canvas, and sometimes it would be from a tin can. It may have been from a bucket with a hole in the bottom. I'm not sure. But, you know, certainly there was a level of fluidity to the way in which the paint was applied. It wasn't applied by a brush or a palette knife or anything like that.
Let's focus in on the drips. So if you then hang that bucket full of paint above a canvas, and you can see if you go onto YouTube, there's artists that do this.
Yeah.
And then you push the bucket in sort of angular way. It's going to make drips that you can imagine you could get it to start off making sort of an eight sign or an infinity symbol, right?
Yep.
But then it's going to quickly change the angle of its motion. And the dynamics of the movement of that bucket on a string, and it's going to start producing much less predictable motions, which then build up over time on top of each other, creating a very chaotic scene on that canvas. And so if you think about it, every single motion of that bucket was roughly similar and certainly linear and certainly in some senses plottable as a function, but the finished result would be absolutely nuts chaos, right? And this comes into, we get drawn into things like the three body problem and stuff here, in the fact that systems like that are inherently hard to predict. And then, you know, that's why we have the three body problem, where you've got three celestial bodies effectively orbiting each other, and those orbits, without knowing the starting state, are pretty much impossible to predict. And we're not quite there with the bucket, but you're starting to get into those realms where you can't unpick that painting. It's not like a knot that can be untied. You know what I mean? You probably will never know what the starting state with that was. You could not unpick that. And in that sense, it's quite fractal. right? So cool. So I wrote like a lot of notes on this, right? Because once I started looking at it, I was like, wow, this goes all over the place. So here's some other stuff, right? Mirrors reflected in mirrors, right?
Yeah.
That's fractal, right? It's recursive.
Yes, it's recursive for sure.
And so you see that in painting, particularly with people painting themselves in mirrors and stuff. So there's a self-similarity going on there. I've mentioned psychedelia. We have things like Persian rugs. Well, I say Persian rugs, I think I just mean rugs, right? Those sort of woven rugs that have got, yeah, they've just got repeating motifs and patterns in them. And this is apparently particularly prevalent in sort of Persian, African early art that was doing recursive structures from very early on. There's one in Turkey I come across called the Dome of the Selimiye Mosque. Excuse me, Turkish people, if I got that wrong, in Edirne, Turkey, which is like, if you're looking up at St. Paul's Cathedral, it's like that with tons of fractal images on it. So this, you know, as again, unlike the golden ratio, this really does turn up. I was thinking about Magritte, for example. He goes fractal both in theme and imagery. For example, you've got the picture of the landscape in front of the landscape, right? Perfectly matches the landscape. MC Escher.
Yep.
And we're going to have to do more than one episode on Escher. But those pencil drawings are fractal-ish.
There's a level of topology and its use of fractals. So he started out using mathematics intuitively, and then through dialogue with, mathematicians, academics, his knowledge of mathematics increased, and he started doing work that was inspired by mathematics, and fractals and topology definitely core to his practice. And again, when you start talking about Magritte and Escher and psychedelia, you start to link into that kind of like dreamlike state, you know, is it real? Is it a dream? And that's something that seems to be fundamental, even if you're just looking at, some of the computer simulations of fractals. They become landscapey very quickly, and you're not quite sure whether you're looking at a screen or a landscape, an imagined landscape, a real landscape, or anything like that. And so you get this kind of dreamlike quality, which also, I think from an artistic perspective, is quite an interesting altered state of consciousness that the viewer and the audience encounter is quite receptive to.
Well, obviously, and if you're taking a bunch of LSD or that peyote would be, or psilocybin or something like that, that's going to feel quite profound. And I think back to the concept of being able to sort of visualize infinity, that you don't get much more psychedelic than that. And, you know, I've never actually done psychedelics, but because my brain is already quite psychedelic and I don't think I need to add to that. But I think, you know, this idea that you sort of gazing into the infinite, and it comes out as well in sort of meditation in Hindu and Buddhist traditions around meditation and stuff. There's a lot of recursion and fractalism in Hindu arts, particularly in things like temples, where you see smaller versions of like the gods and so on. So there's loads of that. I think there's a lot of overlap between meditation culture and psychedelic culture. I want to talk about music.
Thanks,
because right. I got lost down a rabbit hole yesterday. Was like, I was sort of wandering around the countryside as usual, thinking about this. So what are we going to talk about? And suddenly J.S. Bach popped into my head. And I was like, yeah, I'm sure there's something there with his stuff. And I'm sure it has something to do with fugues and canons. So I was wandering around. So I went and onto Spotify and did a search for podcasts that had fugues or canons in it, Bach feudal fugues and canons. And there's this guy, and I'll put the show note, the link in the show notes. It's called WTF Bach. And he does like a detailed breakdown of Bach's Art of the Fugue, right? Which is like a suite of musical pieces. They're quite short, which are either fugues or canons. And it's bonkers, right? It's insane. So a canon, the classic canon is Row, Row, Row Your Boat, right? Where you start singing, I'll start singing, and we're not going to do this, by the way, Mark.
That's a shame.
No, I really don't want to. So Row, Row, Row Your Boat. And then when I say boat, you come in, row, row, row your boat. And then Joe Blogstud joins in and so on. And you can have, you know, large numbers of people singing that song, all having started at different times, and it all makes harmonious sense, right? So already you have a fractal sense of that, and also a sort of chaotic sense of that, where when you hear the full crescendo, where every voice is overlapped, that you you still have the form of the original song in there, but it's much more complex. There's much more going on. So that's a canon. And so Bach wrote a lot of canons. Mozart did. They're all over classical music, and you'll find them. And they, what's really interesting, I find, about canons, because a canon is simply that, right? There can be some variations in it in the sense that, for example, you could have the same motif, but inverted or reversed or half timed, or you know, the runs along the same time as the original, the main voice are called the subject, and it still makes sense. And then if you chop, say, like a 10 or 15 second chunk out the middle of this, where it's most, when most of the voices are overlapping, then it's going to seem completely bonkers and senseless. It's going to sound totally disordered, because really canons only make sense when you listen to them from the beginning, so that you're introduced to the subject and the first voice, and then the others come in. And so the next level up from canons is fugues, which is like canons on steroids. And so fugues will have a particular motif that is, but then they have a little bit more variance in them. They have movements. You'll have sort of breaks from the main voice. But those breaks are all overlapped with the main voice. And so they come in at different time with different voices, with the bass and the tenor and all this stuff, right? It's crazy. I don't explain this very well. But it builds up this insane level of complexity. And that was already blowing my mind, trying to listen to these pieces and going, what the hell is going on here? This is mad. How does someone think this up, right? And then I was reading about the Art of Fugue, which is the same bloody motif across different movements of fugue, and then canons for every fugue. So the whole thing is about the same combination of like 15 notes or something, right? And it's every level. And then it's backwards, and then it's forwards, and then it's slow, and then it's fast. And then it's double notes or triples or doubles for each note. And it just blows my mind. Did I like listening to it? Not particularly. Did I think it was amazing? Yes. There you go. That was me getting enthusiastic about Bach, even though I don't actually like the music. But it's a really good example of sort of fractal and recursive structures in such a sort of visceral way. In the way that music affects you,
I think it's a very an emotional resonance. But also, one of the books I was reading, a book called Art and Fear.
Yes, and that's one of my favourite books on art. That's such a good book.
It is. It's an amazing book because it tells it like it really is. And but again, the conversation about fugues was around. When you're listening, you've got parts where it's highly harmonious and then parts where it's not. and you've got this bridge, this emotional journey as a viewer and an encounter, which takes you from harmony to disharmony back to harmony again. And so you've almost got this kind of, although the mathematical underlying principle is simple, it leads to very complex structures that have a highly emotive resonance for us as humans. It's one of the most emotive art forms that exists. So it takes you on this journey. And one of the reason it is so emotive is because although you can kind of partially predict where it's going, there's also a level of uncertainty that you can't. And that's where the brilliance of these musical composers comes into play. But as an art encounter, I think it's really interesting how, you know, what is in many ways starting off with a simple form becomes so complex and so emotionally resonant for an audience encounter. It's highly interesting.
Yeah, I'd love to see it live, actually. I think it might have a more profound experience on me, a more profound effect on me. Have you ever read or tried to read Gerd Lische Back by Douglas Hofstadter?
I haven't so far.
You really should. Basically,
my reading list now.
If I was to chop off your top of your head and peer into your brain, my guess is that it would look like Gerd Lische Back, right? This was written in the 70s. And it's one of the most bonkers books you'll ever read. I can't get through it. I've tried several times. But it talks a lot about the recursion and the fractal nature. But it sort of builds up this case for thinking about human consciousness as what it calls a strange loop. There's actually a sequel to it written much more recently called I Am a Strange Loop. And it makes the case for these recursions and fractal structures, in a framework of Gödel and his incompleteness theory, which is another thing we'll have to come back to, Isha and Back, and effectively starts to parallel these theories on self-similarity, chaos, recursion with the way that human consciousness is and the very existence of human consciousness. So it's well worth a read, but it's not holiday reading. It doesn't sound
like it, but it's really interesting. One of my recent Instagram posts was again another Mona Lisa, so a variant, topological variant of the Mona Lisa, and I made a comment in terms of the notes saying it feels like I'm in a loop. It just feels like, you know, sometimes you get into a loop where you're creating work that you just can't get out. It's not quite an obsession, but it just feels that you've got to play this story out and you can't let go, or it won't let go of you. So you're not really in control anymore. It's just like you're looping around until you can escape, but you're not in control. You're part of this recursive formula that's playing out, and you're just one of the pawns within it. It's quite fascinating.
I am a recursion. I'm very repetitious and I'm very recursive. And so, yes, I am a strange loop. So here's some other places it crops up in my mind. In jazz, John Coltrane in particular, and probably Miles Davis. John Coltrane, if you listen to Love Supreme, that has some repetitive, recursive elements in it. It's probably a hard to fathom, and again, not a piece of music I love, but I love the idea of. I am certain that Pink Floyd fans would argue for recursion, particularly on Dark Side of the Moon, and I would argue probably Shine On You Crazy Diamond part one was quite recursive, but that whole album is. Any other music you can think of that fits this?
I'm just thinking about repetition of form. So again, when I'm thinking about work by Philip Glass, I wouldn't say it's got a level of recursiveness to it.
Yeah.
And then you've got Snow Patrol as well.
There's a really good podcast series on Radiohead's In Rainbows that deconstructs it track by track, bar by bar. There's a ton of recursion in there, in Radiohead's In Rainbows, but probably OK Computer as well.
Yeah, no, but that repetition of form, you know, taking one thing and then it repeats and then you get another layer on top. So it's a, you know, it's kind of a modern form of canon within the pop genre. And, yeah. and that for me is something that resonates all the time. And so a lot of my work has got a musical inspiration, even though I don't really talk about it very much, but it's to do with that layering and that repetition of notes and rhythm. And how it layers up. It's really an interesting thing. I find it very inspiring.
Well, the repetition, so you've got things like polyrhythms and stuff. In music, you want polyrhythms. You need Meshuggah, a metal band who pioneered some really wacky stuff using polyrhythms. But effectively, time signatures within time signatures, rhythms within rhythms. And the fact is, you know, this is where we get back into the infinite, is that music, time signatures are just time broken down into repeating chunks, and you can effectively keep chopping things down into smaller and smaller chunks of sound. Now, of course, if you do that and you play it, as the more you chop, you know, the more kinks you make in the musical waveform. That's the higher frequency. The higher the frequency, the higher the note, right? And so you get this concept of the point where the note gets so high it's not audible anymore. And that's almost like, in human terms, is the a musical note converging to infinity, right? Because we haven't mentioned calculus, but we definitely get into calculus territory here quite quickly. And so I think the beats and the nature of music in itself is recursive. It is fractal, and just the very essence of sound waves themselves. You know, God, we could touch on bloody Fourier transforms and crap like that as well here. Oh God, I think this episode has been like making a list of other episodes.
It could well be. It could well be. It's got a sense fractal in its own structure today.
My God, this is a recursive episode. How amazing is that? I'm still going to go through my list. Right, here's some other things. I think stuff like Catch 22, Gravity's Rainbow, Slaughterhouse 5, a Canticle for Leibowitz is all about recursion of themes within like human history. 100 Years of Solitude is all about history repeating. Asimov's Foundation is very, very fractal in the sense where you get this is sort of like country versus empire versus space empire versus universal empire, and the repetition, the fact that history can be or the future can be predicted by looking at the variables within history, because ultimately history keeps repeating. Social structures repeat, right? You see a structure around you where you've got friends in a friend group or in the workplace, which is repeated at a company scale and repeated at a national scale, repeated at a global scale. And then when we conquer the planets, it will be recorded, you know, repeated at a planetary scale. So that's Asimov's foundation.
I was thinking about, you know, musically, I was thinking about harmonies rather than symphonies. And again, you know, when you start looking at the harmonics, you know, someone like John Taverner, his work again has got that recursive feel to it. And I think you get this intensity of, I'd almost say, color in the way that his musical compositions work. So for me, it's kind of linked to Russian Orthodox icons and also to, you know, Mark Rothko's abstract paintings as well. So it's weird. It's a weird old thing. But I like harmonics more than symphonics.
If you heard anything but Arvo Pärt?
Not at the moment.
He's a 20th century minimalist composer. There's a piece by him called Fratres. I don't know if that's how you say it, but it's the same piece repeated on different instruments. So there's Fratres for piano, for cello or something, I don't know. And it's the same repetitious piece that sort of builds, and it's so simple, but it's so emotional, it's so affecting. So you know, if you'd like that sort of stuff, and Philip Glass will have absolutely been influenced by Arvo Pärt.
Yeah.
There's a few, and same with Taverner. So Taverner and Part, I think, were contemporaries. So that whole choral side of things gets very, very recursive and the sort of ritual chanting side of things that you'll see in every culture. But also, I love that if you've ever been in a proper church or cathedral while they're doing any type of chanting or choral work, you not only get the mantric nature of the things that they're singing, but also then the echoes from the acoustics in the building. That in itself, you've got your own voice echoed back at you while you're singing. And it's amazing in that you see this a lot in Pink Floyd, I guess to an extent you too, with Edge's, the way that Edge uses guitar, but there's lots of other people doing this where you can put a delay pedal on and it just plays the same thing you just played just a bit later. And you can make, it's really easy to make some amazingly complex and interesting soundscapes just by playing around with a delay pedal. And that's with just the one or two canon-like voices that sort of fade out. But then imagine in a church where you've got the different, your voice reflecting off different surfaces. And so you've got the repetition is coming back at lots of different times and they're all overlapping with each other, but still it sounds amazing, you know, when it should sound complete nonsense. Whereas, quite frankly, if you played like some death metal in a cathedral, it probably would sound absolutely awful, which is why, well, most people say it sounds awful anyway, but it would be more unintelligible because I don't think that would work. What has to be like choral music, has to be simple music in that environment.
Well, we've covered a lot of ground yet again today, Alex, and we'll need to sign off soon, I guess. But
we'll bring this to a close. I think this was me getting enthusiastic about something that I got lost down a rabbit hole about. Don't know what we're going to do next.
It all makes sense because it's recursive. Don't worry.
Yes, indeed. I'm recursing at myself. So let's get together again soon. I will probably tick one of the subjects off that we've just talked about. So I'm really looking forward to that. But I've enjoyed this conversation. This is good. We should do more of these.
Very inspiring. And watch out for the next one we release. Thank you.
Thank you for coming. Bye. I'm sorry.